this morning, I thought it would be, I've been thinking lately and sort of a theme about, lately meaning over the last number of months, a theme that we can talk about in general is the difference in a way between our religious practice, what we're trying to do in this kind of religious practice, and what they might be doing in psychotherapy, or how a psychologist might approach the same kinds of issues that we approach in our religious practice. And this subject will partake of really a topic that you could call the relationship between religion and science, and that sort of thing, or religion and rationality even, or rational inquiry. There is I want to call it a dialogue, but it's more like a fight in Western intellectual circles or Western cultural circles, talking about the relationship between religion and science. And there's a presupposition that there's a conflict between religion and science in the West. And it's always, whenever you hear people talking about it, it's almost always this idea that religious people are rejecting science, from kind of both sides in a way. And I think it's really quite sad, in a sense, and quite important to recognize that Buddhism is almost never included in that dialogue. Buddhism and the Buddhist approach is almost never included in that dialogue, and it's almost always a dialogue referring to the Abrahamic religious traditions and Western science. And so, in a sense, I find it to be kind of a sad kind of conflict, because to my point of view, my experience, there is no conflict between religion and science. There really isn't a problem. They're not really mutually exclusive or mutually incompatible. But they are different ways of thinking about the world, and it's useful, I think, to understand what those differences are, and particularly when it comes to psychology or the study of the mind from a scientific point of view, because we're dealing with the same kinds of issues. We're dealing with the same kinds of problems and things that arise in people's experience and mind. Of course, generally speaking, psychology is just the study of the human mind from a particular perspective. And then there's the subcategory of psychology, which is what you call psychotherapy, which is the study of how to resolve problems from that perspective. So there's an overlap between what happens in psychotherapy specifically and what happens in religion, where you have some issue, some problematic issue that's causing you suffering, and we're trying to ask the question, well, how do I deal with that issue? And a psychologist will have a particular approach to it, and a religious person will have a particular approach to it. Again, I think it's very important to recognize that inherently there isn't really a conflict between those two approaches. So in religion, the word religion taking it apart at its roots, it means relinking or reconnecting, specifically reconnecting to the source of existence. And you know, the word religios is the same root as ligature or ligament, and that is a connective tissue or a unifying force or connection. And so, in general, I think we can kind of say that the purpose of our religious practice is to reconnect with or re-energize or reunify our life and intention with the deepest principle. In Buddhism, we might call that Buddha nature, cosmic Buddha, the nature of existence. And that deepest nature of things is talked about in a lot of different ways. I had a couple of kids here, and we were looking at a video game, an online video game called The World of Minecraft. I don't know if you ever played it, but it's an interesting game, and so one of the kids was showing me how it works, and one of the things you do is it involves digging into this virtual ground and making tunnels and fighting monsters and doing all that stuff. But one of the things that you can do is dig down so deep that you fall into the void, that you kind of pierce through to the bottom of the world and you fall into the void. Of course, in the world of Minecraft, when you fall into the void, you die. That's just a sort of instant death. But in a way, it kind of reminded me of my own kind of way of thinking about this deepest nature of things. And there's a way of talking about it, awakening in Zen, which is a description called having the bottom of your bucket drop out. You, in a sense, kind of reach the bottom of your mind, and the bottom of it falls out, and things shift, and there's a difference. It's as if you've kind of fallen into the void. Although, happily, in religious practice, you don't die when you fall into the void. Things shift in a quite positive way. And to me, that's what, in a sense, the kind of essence of practice is, to open up the channel to that deepest thing and allow it to permeate our life. So part of doing that, part of going through that process of reconnecting to that deepest thing, is asking and answering the question, why am I not connected to it now? What is the obstacle to my connection at present? And then looking at our mind, and the Buddha's teaching is, we're not aware of it, we're not connected to it, we're not awakened to it because of the mental obscurations which keep us from seeing it. One of the hallmarks of our tradition is that people, beings, existence is one with Buddha nature already. We have and are given expression to Buddha nature right now as we are, but we don't see it, or many of us don't see it, or we don't see it completely. So the purpose of practice then is to come to see that thing, and the reason that we don't see it is because of the mental patterns which are obscured, our mental habits which obscure it. And so again, when we come to practice, in general, people come to practice for two different reasons. These are kind of two broad reasons. Of course, everybody's quite unique and has their own specific kind of mixture or angle on this, and that's worth noting for yourself. But in general, people come to religious practice for two different reasons. They come because they're pushed by the suffering that they have. You know, you feel lousy, and you think, God, there's got to be something better. I have to be able to find something better than this. I have a hunch that it's out there, and I'm going to go and find it, and I have to kind of deal with this suffering. The other way that we can get drawn into religious practice is that we're not necessarily particularly suffering, but we just have a strong sense that there is something more. There is a positive thing which pulls us toward practice. In one sense, the suffering kind of route is being pushed to practice. In the other route, it's being pulled toward practice. In some sense, the person who's pulled toward practice actually has a more difficult time. Because they aren't necessarily convinced that there's any particular problem which obscures them from a deeper understanding of their religious practice. They're not necessarily convinced that their behavior, what they're doing, how they're acting, how they're thinking, is connected to an obscuration of their deeper connection. And so when you begin to practice, again, you come for these two different reasons, and the person who you come to, or the group that you come to, is saying, okay, you want to practice, you want to find this deeper connection. What you'll have to do is start looking at what's going on in your mind, what's going on in there, what's happening, how are you creating suffering for yourself? And the person who's pulled toward religious practice may or may not want to embrace that at this particular time, because they may already feel some happiness or satisfaction. And so the whole kind of prospect of looking in there at taking a closer look at what's going on, really going on in your mind, and seeing what you're doing to create suffering may not be all that comfortable, and so why go down that road? So in a sense, the people who have a more difficult time, who are pushed toward practice, have a little bit easier time, or potentially easier. So we need to then deal with the suffering that arises in our minds. I'm going to describe, I am still talking about the difference between religion and psychotherapy, and I'm going to talk about this from the perspective of a religious practitioner, because of course that's what I do, that's how I look at things. And I don't actually have that much experience of psychotherapy. I've never been to a therapist or anything like that, so I don't really know what's going on. I've only done reading and talked to various people, so that's my experience there. But I imagine that most people who go to see a therapist go because they feel like they have a problem that they need to resolve, that they have some issue that they need to sort out, and they want some practical help in sorting out those issues, regardless of what type of therapist you go to. Now, this Buddhism and Zen, my mother told me once the difference, she's a Christian or kind of sort of basically Christian-oriented kind of person, spiritual person. She once told me, and I don't necessarily ascribe to this, but it gives you an idea of what kind of views there are. She said that the difference between, she thought, between Buddhism and Christianity was that Buddhism was a religion of the mind, had an approach of the mind, and Christianity was more emotionally or heart-based kind of practice. I don't really know if that's true, but there is a strong component of Buddhist practice which is very analytical. And my talk today, you know, kind of comes, I'm talking to you from my kind of analytical self, in a sense. And that's because I want to kind of clarify this in an intellectual way or whatever. So there is a part of Buddhist practice which is quite analytical. And because of that, we can conclude, if we're not really careful, that it is doing, in a sense, the same thing that therapy is doing, or psychotherapy is doing. Because, of course, the way that a psychotherapist is going to approach the mind is from a scientific perspective. May have different skillful means in there, but that's basically their premise. There's behavior that needs to be relearned, and we can teach people how to relearn behavior and come to understand themselves better and deal with their suffering. So it's analytical in its approach. The process of looking at ourselves from the perspective of Zen practice has an analytical element to it. I'm looking at causality. I'm trying to find out what I do that creates suffering, what I do that creates an obstruction to my deeper sense of religious practice. And in that sense, there's also kind of experimental quality to it, because I'm experimenting. If I let go of certain kinds of thinking, how will that help me? And then I'm seeing how that affects me. If I indulge in certain kinds of thinking, what effect does that have? If I do certain kinds of behavior, what effect does that have? If I don't do certain kinds of behavior, what effect does that have? So there's a sort of experimental quality to meditation practice, which I think is quite important. But it's also based on the view that we're experimenting in a realm and from a perspective of cultivating a deeper connection to our deeper self. And that's where meditation comes in, which is really a type of contemplative prayer, kind of inviting the reality of life to help us, in a sense. So there's a couple of different things going on in religious practice that aren't necessarily going on in a strictly therapeutic psychological perspective. I was reading a book recently, written by a psychotherapist about different treatment methodologies for dealing with various issues of addiction. And she was saying, you know, this is a person who has worked a lot with different addiction issues and helped a lot of people kind of come to grips with their addiction issues. And one of the interesting things she said was that at some point she will inevitably encourage people to seek a deeper connection with a faith tradition, just as part of her helping people come to deal with their addiction issues. And I thought that was quite interesting, and it kind of is borne out in, if you look at, say, AA, which is kind of a popular psychology, in a sense, based methodology for dealing with addiction issues. One of the cornerstones of AA is faith in some kind of higher power, or whatever. And it's one of the most effective kind of addiction kind of methods that there are, and incorporates a lot of different features that this woman was also incorporating into her various kind of addiction programs. So there, and in a sense, that is my view of how things go with regard to therapy and religious practice. That there is a thing which we are doing in religious practice which is not necessarily covered in the world of therapy. And we benefit from each other, in a sense. Historically, up until maybe beginning 100 years ago, well, I guess we have to go to Freud, really, so 150 years ago, something like that. Before that, before Freud started the idea of working with a therapist to work out your problems, people with difficult issues would go to their priest, or go to a religious person. And that was also true in the European context, but it's also true in Asian context with Buddhism and other kind of Asian religions. You go to a priest or a spiritual person and help work out the problems from that perspective. And so, kind of historically speaking, in terms of Buddhist practice, a monk or a priest in whatever Buddhist tradition you would be in would be a kind of combination between the religious person but also a sort of quasi-therapist for community. People with mental difficulties would go to a priest, or often go to a priest, or that kind of person, and they would be working with them to resolve those issues in that context. In really the last 50 years, therapy, psychotherapy, has gained a great deal of prominence in the West, and has, in a sense, for Westerners, taken over that role that a priest would have used. Predominantly for most people in this culture. And from my perspective, that's fine. Because in a sense, they have a more sophisticated kind of tools and approach to things. Although, interestingly, many therapists have incorporated practices from Buddhism in their therapy regimes these days. So for me, I mean, I've got my mental issues. Got my suffering that I deal with, And I sometimes think, oh, I wonder if I should go and see a therapist. And I'm sure if you, you know, knew me more, you might think, you ought to go see a therapist. but so far for me, it has been effective to deal with my difficulties, my mental, mental, psychological, spiritual problems by doing training and approaching them from the perspective of training and finding peace through training in Buddhist practice. So there isn't necessarily, I'm not advocating any kind of particular approach for any particular person, just to say there is a possibility of dealing with suffering through training. And there is no conflict with doing a sort of therapeutic, psychological kind of work as well. Are there any questions so far?
You mentioned that a lot of psychotherapists have incorporated Buddhist skillful tools, skillful means, knowingly or unknowingly, or a little bit of both?
A little bit of both. I mean, the whole thing about meditation, you know, you go to your insurance company these days and they're recommending that people meditate. For health benefits, and there's a whole kind of effort to work with mindfulness among therapeutic regimes and models, and a lot of this has been brought in deliberately, but also when it comes in, it's usually stripped of its religious significance. And, you know, like meditation is done as a relaxation technique. And from the perspective of myself and people practicing Zen, many people practicing Zen, there is a deeper quality, deeper aspect of meditation that, again, goes to that issue of reconnecting that religious aspect of Zen. There are some Zen practitioners and teachers who eschew that idea, that notion that there's anything deeper, and don't necessarily emphasize that. I'm not one of them. So typically when a religious practice and meditation and mindfulness, well, mindfulness is pretty Buddhist. I don't think there's many other yogic traditions that use mindfulness, but meditation, of course, has many different, there are many different people who practice meditation. When those things come into therapy, then again, they're usually stripped of their religious significance, or that's not necessarily talked about.
It's just more practical type of...
More practical, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't say that when I was going to any Christian church that... I don't think I ever heard the word mindfulness, to be honest with you. And that's not a negative, it's just an observation that an awareness I just had that, yeah, you're right, you know, I don't ever remember that word coming up. Maybe more so nowadays because it is more practical. I don't know.
There is also then another, and this, what you say, reminds me of another dimension of difference. One of the purposes, one of the things about psychology or psychotherapy, and again, this goes to the point of it only goes to a certain point, is how to construct a different behavior pattern. But the other part of meditation practice that is not necessarily incorporated in that is the positive cultivation of other qualities. The qualities of compassion, love, and wisdom specifically, loving kindness and generosity. These qualities are not necessarily cultivated in the psychotherapeutic model. Although lately I was reading, I've read a lot of interesting studies about the benefit of generosity, for instance, from a psychological kind of point of view. So these things will, I'm sure, gradually begin to be cultivated from this perspective of psychology. Yes.
Do you feel or think that while psychology may not proactively promote any certain virtue, or, you know, moral virtue, that perhaps the way that it's practiced as sort of questioning everything, if all behavior is under analysis between a therapist and a client, then if all the clients and all the therapists have access to Buddha nature, and because we share that, if just questioning everything can lead to what I would think would be the right answer of compassion, wisdom, etc.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and yeah, I think that's quite likely to happen. The more you begin to look at it, the more you begin to adjust your behavior, the more you begin to cease from activity which creates suffering, you in a sense will want to replace that behavior with other things, and those things are going to be, in a sense, positive. And because everything has Buddha nature, and really, I just put that name on it, Buddha nature. It's part of reality. It's not something that I have exclusive descriptive power over or anything like that. It just exists in people. So people are constantly giving expression to it all the time. And the more you refine your behavior to non-suffering behavior, the more you are giving expression to that. Now, there is, going back to the kind of example of World of Minecraft and breaking through the bottom of your bucket, there is a quality of meditation practice which is not approached through just behavior, and in a way can't be described in normal terms of love, compassion, or even normal wisdom, like the wisdom of changing your tires before you have a blowout. And that quality of, there's an important thing to remember about science, which I think good scientists have in mind, is that science is a kind of analytical approach to the world. There is much more about the world that is unknown than is known. And part of the, I contend, and actually some scientists, mathematicians will contend, that part of the problem with that situation is that part of what's going on in the world actually can't be known from a rational or analytical point of view. I'm just going to throw this out there because it may not make any sense to anybody but me, which isn't really that significant. But anyway. And to this issue of knocking the bottom out of the bucket is how we, in a sense, approach things which are not really explainable by rational means. And one of the things that we're constantly, so one of the things that how this works practically, one of the things that we are constantly kind of talking about here is the importance of simple acceptance of situations. Simply accepting. See, some of the things that we encounter in our minds, we actually won't be able to change. Even though we might see that they're not that great or that they cause suffering. we may not be able to actually change them. We may not be able to change, this is much more likely, we may not actually be able to change what's going on in the world. We may not, I mean, everybody doesn't want to sign up to the program of therapy or religious practice. So everybody's going to kind of keep doing what they do, and there's going to be suffering out there. So one of the things we're constantly pointing at is the simple act of acceptance, the simple practice of acceptance. And this goes to that point of that where rationality ends, the usefulness of rationality ends, and the realm of religious practice opens up and begins to help us. It goes to the point of where meditation really begins to take on a transformative prospect in our life, where we begin to be able to just simply accept what is, accept how things are, accept our own mind and limitation. And in that place of acceptance, there begins, you begin to see a way to positively respond to what's going on in the world or what's going on in our minds. We begin to positively be able to work with those things about ourselves that we can't necessarily change. There's a kind of great quote that River Master Ji, in her kindness, gave to us. I'll put it like that. She said that even for a person who is awakened deeply to the truth, it may take a lifetime of effort and training to have any eradicative effect on the patterns of behavior that they encounter in their mind. So even though we begin to awaken to what's most deeply true, even though we bust the bottom out of our bucket, we still have to deal with the world in our mind, and we may not be able to change that immediately, or it may take a long time to change. It will be radically different how we deal with it and how we're able to live at peace with it, but we may not be able to make a significant change in it for most of our life. And I think this is really quite an important thing to have in the background, have, you know, kind of remember, particularly when dealing with other people and with ourselves, that people, I don't know, the image that comes to mind is people, ourselves included, really, the kind of best way to deal with them is just with loving acceptance, just as they are. And in that sense, it is an offering of recognition of Buddha nature within them, even when they're doing stupid things. even when I'm doing stupid things. And this is in a sense where we can leave, in a sense, psychology behind and begin to practice in a different world than is merely described in rational scientific means. It's not that we, there's a nice, you know, the word transcend is an important principle to have in mind. It's not that we discard science or the practical wisdom of what might be useful in terms of behavioral psychology. We don't discard it, but we step beyond it. And sometimes that means not pursuing those methods, but sometimes it doesn't. And it's not like we're saying this thing, this scientific idea is invalid. We're just saying, I'm going to transcend it. I'm going to go beyond it and live in a slightly different way than is described by that model. Yes, ma'am.
It seems so obvious that that religion, this is so general, but that religion is more limited at science than science is. But it doesn't always seem obvious that science has religious limitations.
Yes.
As far as describing reality and sometimes it just seems more obvious. Of course, you know, when you practice religion, you're not going to collide electrons or whatnot, but it doesn't always seem as obvious that when you learn about things in school or when you read books, that you are doing something that has an inherent limitation.
This is one of my kind of favorite kind of areas of thought, and was kind of instrumental in my kind of practice, coming to practice and discarding academic life in a way. There's a great, again, this is pretty obscure, but there's a great little mathematical proof by a mathematician named Kurt Gödel, and in which he talks about that very principle that within science, within math, you will always have to, he made a little kind of elegant proof saying you always have to refer to, you will never be able to prove a mathematical system from within that mathematical system itself. You will always have to refer outside of it to some higher order explanation to make a proof of the of a mathematical principle. And what this implies is that there will just be this ever continuing expansion of knowledge that is never proved. But it also implies that there's always going to be something outside of it. And in a sense, it, you know, this really turns upside down the notion that we will ever be able to prove something from within a rational system and have a perfect description of it. Of course, nobody pays attention to that because they're all in pursuit of the best explanation that they can. And that's fine. That's how our knowledge expands, and it's very useful. You know, all we have in this room, all we have, you know, our means of getting to the temple today, our phones, everything, all of that stuff is created by people's pursuit of a rational explanation of how the world works. And it's great. You know, I love it. It's neat. But we do need to be able to do exactly what you're saying, recognize that there is just a limit to what that scientific approach will be able to do for us. It doesn't satisfy something. It doesn't satisfy that wish, which many people feel, to reconnect, to understand their connection to the deepest reality of life, and to experience that. And so, in that sense, that is what I see as us trying to do here, is, in a sense, preserve that and cultivate it. Yes?
Einstein apparently was the person who thought along those lines. And, he said at some point, you know, he said he just looked out at this great mystery and accepted the beauty of it.
Right.
And he realized, I think, that limitation of science too. Although he was still working on his unified field theory as long as he died.
Sure, yeah.
Because he understood that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and in that exact way, there is no real conflict between science and religion. Just, it's useful to recognize the limitations of both and where both can support and help each other. Okay. Hopefully that will be... hopefully that will be useful to people. And anything else?
It's important, and one of the things we have to be kind of careful about in religious practice is not, we want to cling to an explanation of how the world works. We want to cling to, it's so comforting to have a rational explanation of why I behave this way or why the world is like this, so that we can then have some power over it or affect a change in it. We want to hold on to that notion. And one of the things that's quite hard to do is to just let go of that notion, that we're ever going to actually be able to completely understand it and therefore control it. And that's a very hard place to be, find yourself in, and to let go of and go beyond it.